Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to the LA Steel Show. I'm Lila.
She is so much faster than I am with this. She jumps right on it. This is Leo, and we want to. Tonight we have a great show. We're going to cover a lot of news here tonight, but we also have an interview that we did a few weeks ago with John McManus of the John Birch Society, and talking about his book, The Financial Terrorism, but talking mostly about the economic meltdown and
how relevant his book, which was written a few years ago, is to today, really predicting a lot of the stuff that's happened, which is sort of scary.
He predicted this to happen back in 1992, and we had a civil recession between then and now, but this is, of course, the worst, and looks like the this is the big one. That he was talking about, and
he thought it would happen a bit sooner than it did,
but
it has come later rather than sooner.
But the economy has been rather resilient, and the financial terrorists, which are the Federal Reserve and the other globalist bankers, are have managed to didn't quite get it. They needed George Bush to finalize it. The death of the United States, as well as the as Obama to wonder if he'll finish it, but we will see. But a couple of interesting articles we want to read to you tonight. Of course, everybody is aware of the Palestinian issue going on, but we're going to this one we didn't get a chance to read this whole one the other night. I think it's kind of interesting that. While people are...
I did read most of it, but I'll read it again.
I think it's worth reading
this
again tonight.
This is from Mail Online.
Everybody thinks
Gaza
that...
Gaza is torn apart by war. Where is Middle East peace envoy Tony Blair?
Where is Tony Blair? Well, this article tells
you. Well, the British don't want him in Britain.
He's on vacation.
This is by Matthew Coleman. For the last 9 days, and this was written January 5th, for the last 9 days, the eyes of the world have been on war-torn Gaza as it descended into an all-out conflict and hundreds lost their lives. Yet Middle East envoy Tony Blair was far from the action, spending Christmas and New Year with his family. For at least part of the time, he was in London, where he was spotted at a special private opening of the Armani store in Knightsbridge. In a weekend interview, Gordon Brown was asked if he had talked to his predecessor since the crisis began. He replied, "Tony's on holiday at the moment." It was not until Saturday that Mr. Blair arrived in his office in Jerusalem, and he has yet to pay his first visit to the Gaza Strip. Liberal Democratic leader Nick Clegg said people in the Middle East are entitled to ask themselves, "Where is this Tony Blair?" So far, he's been conspicuous by his absence. More than 500 people have already lost their lives in the conflict in the Gaza, launched by Israel just over a week ago in a bid to stop Hamas rocket attacks. After days of punishing airstrikes, Israel unleashed its ground troops over the weekend. Its leaders say they do not want to occupy Gaza, but teach Hamas a lesson. Hamas leaders have in turn pledged to turn the embattled region into a graveyard for Israeli troops, who come from a country they refuse to recognize. Today, diplomats and world leaders were battling to bring some kinds of ceasefire, but so far all attempts at a deal have been rebuffed. Mr. Blair became the special envoy for the Middle East Peace Quartet of the United Nations, the European Union, the U.S., and Russia shortly after quitting Downing Street 18 months ago. Aides insist the claims of him being on a holiday are totally untrue. He has, they say, been working tirelessly behind the scenes since day one. The former PM faced a storm of criticism as he finally flew into Israel on a peace mission yesterday, 9 days after the Gaza Strip bombardment began. Mr. Blair arrived in his office in Jerusalem yesterday in an attempt to broker a ceasefire that has left hundreds dead and much of Gaza devastated. But he was blasted for spending Christmas and New Year with his family and failing to speak out more strongly about Israel's military attack on the poverty-stricken Palestinian territory. He flew into the war-ravaged region under tight security with a peace with honor message as Israel launched an all-out invasion to smash Hamas. Ed Davey, the liberal Dem foreign affairs spokesman, said, "At this crucial moment for the Middle East, Tony Blair has the authority to put pressure on both sides for an immediate ceasefire. But his efforts to improve security and the economy on the West Bank so far has produced less than modest dividends. Mr. Blair has never visited the Gaza Strip, despite the fact that more than a third of the 1.5 million Palestinian population live there in abject deprivation. He scrapped a visit there at the last minute in July after Israel warned that Palestinian groups were planning to assassinate him. He was in his official convoy speeding toward a Gaza-Israel border crossing when he was phoned by Israel Defense Minister Ehud Barak. Hamas, which was coordinating security for the visit, dismissed the threat as a lie. Mr. Blair made a brief statement condemning the bloodshed following the start of Operation Cast Lead on December 27th. But commentators in the Arab media expressed surprise that he decided against returning to the violence-ravaged region at the earliest opportunity. The former Prime Minister's spokesman, said Mr. Blair, has been working the phones constantly since the ferocious bombardment of the coastal enclave began. He said he has been working on the issue from the start. An aide added he is not commenting until he sees everybody. Mr. Blair has visited the Middle East for a week each month since taking up the envoy role. He has a large staff of advisors and assistants and the entire fourth floor of the exclusive American Colony Hotel in East Jerusalem. The office space alone costs the British taxpayers £500,000 a year and more when Mr. Blair and his entourage are in town. Yesterday, Mr. Blair was due to hold talks with Israeli and Palestinian leaders, but not Hamas. At the weekend, the moderate King Abdullah of Jordan called on Mr. Blair to say that Israel's military action will fail to bring it security. The ruler said the only way to achieve security is through ensuring that the Palestinians regain their legitimate rights, particularly the right to establish an independent state on their national soil. In an interview yesterday, Gordon Brown suggested that Mr. Blair was on vacation. Asked if he had spoken to the Prime Minister since the crisis began, he said, "Tony's on holiday at the moment." He issued a statement and said his work is very important. However, his intervention prompted Mr. Blair's aides to vehemently deny that he was on holiday. Mr. Blair's spokesman said, "As a quartet representative, Mr. Blair continues to be fully engaged in the current situation he has been working on since day one." He said that Mr. Blair had met senior Israeli and Palestinian politicians yesterday. Suggestions that he had been on holiday were totally untrue, he said. Mr. Blair is understood to have been working on a solution to the crisis from the U.K., including having discussions by telephone with Mr. Brown, Foreign Secretary David Miliband, U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, and King Abdullah of Jordan, among others. Let's see, what's this last paragraph? Teflon was given the Middle East peace. Teflon, that doesn't make sense.
Teflon was given the Middle East peace.
Well, what is that?
Boy.
Who's Teflon? I don't know what that means. So that doesn't make sense.
Well, no. Maybe he's talking about Teflon, meaning they don't stick.
No, yeah. That wasn't what that is at all. Let's see. He accepted thinking he was well owed. It would keep him away from his home country, which loathes him with a passion. So no doubt he thinks, job done. You didn't expect him to actually work for the title, did you? He couldn't keep peace in his own cabinet, so I doubt he's qualified to sort out religious spats that have plagued these areas since biblical times. Oh, I think that was like a blog entry after the article. That's what that was. That's why I didn't. Oh yes, yeah. Comments. Yeah. That's why I didn't understand that.
Okay. Yeah. His name was Stefan.
Yeah, his name was. I was just saying, what does that mean? That was a blog entry, folks. That last one.
Okay.
But the guy did have a good point. He couldn't keep peace in his own cabinet. And the British people have to pay for all of that.
Yeah.
So they're not too thrilled by it.
I'll tell you
so what else do you have?
Oh,
that doesn't make any sense.
Yeah,
that's not a worthwhile article. Leo just picked out an article.
Oh, no, I did, actually.
I didn't like it.
I thought it was good, but
no,
I didn't.
Go ahead. Read that one.
There's so much going on here. There. I got this one we didn't get to.
Go ahead.
You know, you got to go to the United Kingdom. You got to go to English papers to find out what's going on around the world, but because you're not going to find out about it here in the United States. Never found that to be the case. But with our mainstream media, but we want to. One of the latest articles that came up was on Mail Online, DailyMail.co.uk, and it's called "Vaccinating Older People Against Pneumonia is a Waste of Time."
I found that article pretty interesting.
Yeah. Giving jabs to older people against an infection which causes pneumonia is a waste of time, says researchers. Millions of pensioners have been vaccinated with a one-off jab. The jab is an English word for the needle, as part of a government campaign launched 5 years ago. But it does not cut the risk of pneumonia in people age 65 and over, according to researchers carrying out possibly the largest review into efficacy of the vaccine. It looked at 22 trials from several countries involving more than 100,000 people, but unlike similar studies, Swiss researchers investigated why different studies had produced different results. They found only high-quality studies produced reliable results, and they all failed to find any evidence that this kind of vaccine could prevent pneumonia. Those who received pneumonia, PPVs, which are preventive, the vaccine they give to prevent pneumonia, were not less likely to contract pneumonia than those who had not been vaccinated, and little difference in risk of health, of death. The findings are published in the Canadian Medical Association Journal. Countries like Britain currently recommend that people over 65 are given the 9-pound jab, along with the younger people at increased risk due to conditions such as HIV, which suppress the immune system. Dr. Eger from the University of Bern, who led the latest research, said vaccination does not appear to work, even in the elderly.
Excuse me.
He said policymakers may therefore wish to reconsider their current recommendation for a PPV, especially where routine pneumonical conjugate immunizations are being introduced. So in other words, anything to deal with pneumonia, they have the vaccine is worthless, even over 65 and under. And the research was undertaken because of the conflicting results about the efficacy of the jab, which is meant to work against 23 common types of pneumonia disease bugs, Streptococcus pneumonia bacteria can infect the lungs, causing a form of pneumonia. Other forms can be caused by viruses or a nasty bloodstream infection, which is fatal in 20% of cases. And rates of pneumonia and death were analyzed in 22 trials involving 101,000 patients from countries in North America, as well as India, Africa, Latin America, and the Caribbean. And although many observational studies appear to show the vaccine works, they are often biased in a way that exaggerates the effects, said researchers. And although the vaccine is better at preventing bloodstream infections, it is not enough to justify continued public health campaigns. So in a country like Britain, where, you know, you're...
Cost £9 to get one of those.
No, but
your insurance company pays that.
Right, but it's what I'm saying is in the United States, in Britain, where the everything is paid for. You get social medicine, okay, socialized medicine, uh-huh. and birth to death. You know, they're saying that this thing is not worth the investment.
No.
Okay, to prevent pneumonia. It doesn't work. So.
And they give it here all the time, too.
This is pneumonia, though. And
they give it to the elderly all the time.
Still?
Yes, they do.
I know the flu vaccinations cause the flu. It doesn't prevent them. And so we're going to go from there. Lila's got one other, and I wanted to read that one on the Coca-Cola there.
Well, this one is from the Telegraph, also London, by Stephen Adams. Jeffrey Lockwood, a professor of entomology at Wyoming University and author of Six-Legged Soldiers Using Insects as Weapons of War, said such Rift Valley fever or other diseases could be transported into a country by a terrorist with a suitcase. He told BBC Radio 4 today, program, I think a small terrorist cell could very easily develop an insect-based weapon. He said it would probably be much easier than developing a nuclear chemical weapon, arguing the raw material is in the backyard. He continued, it'd be relatively easy and a simple process. A few $100 in a plane ticket and you could have a pretty good stab at it. Governments, he advised, need to have robust pest management infrastructure that's able to absorb and respond to an introduction of infected insects, he said. Trying to stop everything coming at the border would not work. Rift Valley fever is an East African disease which can cause severe disease in both animals and humans, leading to high rates of disease and death, according to the World Health Organization. However, the World Health Organization says the vast majority of human infections result from direct or indirect contact with the blood or organs of infected animals. Well, a pretty good example of an insect carrying disease is Lyme disease carried by the tick.
And the West Nile mosquito, West Nile virus.
Yep.
So they're there.
They're there, and
they're already out there, and they're
pretty deadly stuff.
Here's another deadly thing that's going on.
Yeah, I didn't like hearing about that at all.
This is
upsetting.
This is from the dailymail.co.uk in England again. But it says orange drinks are with 300 times more pesticide than tap water. Fizzy drinks sold by Coca-Cola in Britain have been found to contain pesticides at up to 300 times the level allowed in tap or bottled water. A worldwide study found pesticide levels in orange and lemon drinks sold under the Fanta brand, F-A-N-T-A brand, which is popular with children, were at their highest in Great Britain. But it's all over the world.
Yeah,
and the research team called on the government, the industry, and the company to act to remove the chemicals and call for new safety standards to regulate the soft drinks market. The industry denies children are at risk and insists that the levels found by researchers based on the University of John in Spain are not harmful. Well, the researchers tested 102 cans and bottles of soft drinks bought from 15 countries for the presence of 100 pesticides. The UK products were bought in London, Cambridge, and so on. And the experts said that the levels found were low under the maximum residue levels allowed for fruit, but they were very high and up to 300 times the figure permitted for bottled or tap water. The chemicals detected included carbendazim, thiobendazole, imazolil,
but this one is malathion.
That's the only one we could pronounce.
That's the one I knew.
Malathion and iprodion.
Now, sprayed my malathion on my plants.
Yeah, it's very dangerous.
Yes.
They are mainly applied to fruit after harvest to stop it developing fungal infections and rotting. And, hang on a second. A total of 19 products were bought in the UK, all made by Coca-Cola. Two orange drinks bought in the UK contained imazolil at 300 times the limit permitted for a single pesticide in drinking water, and two similar products contain 98 times the drinking level limit for thiobendazole. and the average level of the total pesticide contamination of British drinks was 17.4 parts per billion and 34.6 parts the EU maximum residential level of water. But the Coca-Cola in Great Britain insisted the products are safe. The spokesman said all of the drinks tested meet the standard regulation relating to food products made from agricultural ingredients, which include drinks with fruit juice as an ingredient. The generally minuscule levels that were detected were well within the acceptable daily intake levels, and these findings should reassure consumers there is no safety issue here. But if there are 300 times the limit permitted for a single pesticide, then there is a problem here. And I just thought that would be an interesting article to bring up. And that was found by Coca-Cola Company stuff, specifically in the Fanta, F-A-N-T-A, Orange, Fanta Zero, of Lemon, and Fanta Fruit Twist. So Orange, Fruit Twist, and Icy Lemon were just some of the ones under the Fanta label that were found to have 300 times the legal limit for tap water are found in their soda pop.
Gary.
Very popular soda pop.
Yeah, I can remember liking that.
Yeah. So anyway, and they sell it cheap. It's a lot cheaper than their, it's kind of like their generic brand. You know?
Oh, I see. It's cheaper than like Coca-Cola.
It's cheaper than their Coke brand, right. Their Coke and stuff like that. So are the major brands.
I didn't realize
that. Yeah. Oh, yeah. And Fanta is a popular brand, but it's a popular, you know.
But it's popular with kids.
Yeah, and people too, you know. It's the kind of stuff you can buy for, $3 for a case or something. You know what I mean? That guy. It's a cheaper one.
Oh.
Yeah. It's a lot in the vending machines too.
Oh.
Yeah.
That's where I've bought it out of a vending
very
machine.
Very
I like orange soda.
Yeah. So anyway, don't drink it.
I guess
and let's see, we get something else here I wanted to bring up.
So what's the next article that you...
there's another one I wanted to read. There's several, but I wanted to read... This one is about Athens policeman gunned down by AK-47, and I think this is... We haven't heard much about the riots anymore.
At all.
They kind of kept it out of the news, the riots that are happening in Athens.
In Greece, yeah.
And in Greece. And it's becoming pretty nasty. And
a policeman was shot and seriously injured in Athens early today as protesters sprayed automatic fire at offices guarding the cultural ministry, prompting fears of renewed anarchist violence. Demantis Matizunas, the 20-year-old policeman, was reported to be in critical but stable condition, with bullet wounds over his whole body from chest to legs. He had been one of the three members of a ministry police guard fired on by two attackers using AK-47 assault rifles and at least one 9mm pistol. The Bohemian Exarchia district, where the ministry is located, was cordoned off and more than 70 people taken in for questioning. 34 cartridges found at the scene were sent for ballistic tests. The attack appeared to be well planned with concentrated fire from at least two directions, said Nikos Karadimas, a police spokesman. The use of AK-47s is a worry. The police is worrying the police, as it's been one of the favorite weapons of the Albanian-Russian underworld. A similar weapon was used in an attack on a police bus carrying a riot squad on December 23rd, with no casualties. Some believe that extremist groups might now be as well-armed as the notorious 17 November group that murdered 23 diplomats, police officers, and businessmen from 1975 to 2002, when it was uprooted with the help of London's Metropolitan Police. The shooting appeared to signal an early end to the unofficial holiday truce that Greece's anarchist groups had signaled they would keep after nearly 2 weeks of destructive inner-city rioting last month. Prokopis Pavlopoulos, the interior minister, said that attackers would soon realize that democracy is strong and society is protected. His government, though, is coming under growing public criticism for its perceived leniency toward rioters and the looters who operate in their wake. The attack occurred less than a half a dozen blocks from the Exarchia district, where 15-year-old Alexandra Grigoropoulos was fatally shot by a ricocheting police bullet on December 6th, an incident that sparked Athens' worst civil disturbances in 30 years and anti-Greek demonstrations in European capitals. Planned left-wing marches on the Israeli embassy in Athens today to protest at the conflict in Gaza were expected to widen into more general anti-police violence. There was renewed tension in the center of Athens as shoppers hurried through their pre-Epiphany Day purchases, fearing new outbreaks of rioting.
Okay.
Pretty scary stuff. I didn't do a very good job on the pronunciation. I do apologize to any of our Greek listeners because I maybe didn't do a good job on pronouncing the name.
I have one more that, actually, I have two more that I'd like to mention, but one very important one for most people to... We don't know. I didn't know this, and none of us really knew this at the time. It's called the Iraq War is now illegal. This really surprised us.
Yeah.
The Bush administration's infatuation with presidential power has finally pushed the country over a constitutional precipice. As of New Year's Day, ongoing combat in Iraq is illegal under U.S. law. In authorizing an invasion in 2002, Congress did not give President Bush a blank check. It explicitly limited the use of force to two purposes: to defend the national security of the U.S. from the threat posed by Iraq and enforce all relevant U.N. Security Council resolutions. 5 years after the fall of Saddam Hussein, the government of Iraq no longer poses a threat. Our continuing intervention has been based on the second clause of Congress' grant of war-making power. Coalition troops have been acting under a series of Security Council resolutions authorizing the continuing occupation of Iraq. But this year, Bush allowed the UN mandate to expire on December 31st without requesting a renewal. At precisely 1 second after midnight, Congress's authorization of the war expired along with this mandate. Bush is trying to fill the legal vacuum with this new status of forces agreement, or SOFA, he signed with the Iraqis. But the president's agreement is unconstitutional since it lacks the approval of Congress. Bush even refused to allow Congress access to the terms of the deal. By contrast, Prime Minister al-Maliki followed his constitution and submitted the agreement for parliamentary approval. While the Iraqi parliament debated its terms, leading members of Congress were obliged to obtain unofficial English translations of texts published by the Arab press. Bush defends his extraordinary conduct by claiming that it is traditional for commander-in-chiefs to negotiate status of forces agreements without congressional consent. But the Iraqi agreement goes far beyond anything in the traditional SOFAs concluded with close to 100 countries since World War II. Indeed, it goes far beyond any sensible interpretation of the president's power as commander-in-chief. For example, the SOFA creates a joint U.S.-Iraqi committee and gives it not the president the broad control over the use of American combat troops. It thereby asserts the authority to restrict President Obama's powers as commander-in-chief throughout most of his first term in office. But under the Constitution, no president can unilaterally limit his successor's authority over the military. This defective agreement cannot serve as a valid substitute for the congressional authorization that Bush so casually allowed to expire on December 31st. It is up to Congress to authorize continuing military action. Gaining the consent of a foreign power simply isn't enough. The question is how Obama should respond to the legal catastrophe that Bush has left as his Iraqi legacy. It's easy to eliminate one option. Whenever the original affirmity of Bush's agreement, Obama should not repudiate it. Now that Maliki has won approval from his parliament, the agreement has become the basis for the next phase of Iraqi politics. It also contains withdrawal timetables that are compatible with Osama's goal. Obama's goal. All combat troops out of Iraq's cities by July. All troops out of Iraq by the end of 2001, or 2011 rather. As a consequence, Obama may be tempted to accept the agreement that Bush has left behind and proceed without correcting its obvious constitutional deficiencies. This article is urging that Congress, immediately approve, an extension on this. However, right now we're operating at illegally in that war. Not that it wasn't illegal before, but it's more illegal now, unconstitutional, and we have to get out of that, as well as the fact that it's costing us $1 billion a day to stay there. So from there on, we will I will keep you updated. Also, I read a report the other day. I was going to bring it up now, but I had misplaced it, that we gave control of the green zone over already to the Iraqi security forces.
Really?
Believe it or not, yeah.
Hmm.
Supposedly they get full authority over the green zone, which is a joke. But anyway, we're going to continue that. But right now, we're going to go to a great interview with John McManus of the John Birch Society. For those of you who don't know, that you can go to jbs.org, jbs.org. Check out their site and check out their what they're promoting. They're a much maligned group, I believe, and I like John McManus very much, and he makes a lot of sense. He's a smart guy, and it makes quite a bit of sense, especially in these times where nobody's making much sense. So we hope that you enjoy this interview. It's about a half an hour, and we'll be back right after that.
McManus is the president of the John Birch Society, and he's been on our show many times before tonight. But tonight he's going to talk about a little bit about his book, Financial Terrorism, which was actually published in the 90s and published for the first time in 1993 in November. And what it talks about is what's happening to the American dream. Financial terrorism cuts through the fog of economic double talk, to answer that question. And that's what John McManus is going to talk to us about, and why it's happening, and about the Obama administration and some of his appointees, and do they fit nicely into the plan of the establishment insiders. Part of their game is the economic game, and with organizations like the Trilateral Commission, the Council on Foreign Relations, how they all play into what's happening to our country and some of the appointments that Obama has made. And I think John McManus is on the phone now.
Yes, good evening, John. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you. How are you?
Very good.
Good evening, John. Welcome to the show.
My pleasure. Thank you.
As we've talked to you before, we were both Leo and I reviewed your book again, Financial Terrorism, right on the money.
Thank you.
Or maybe not on the money, because there doesn't seem to be much of that around in this country these days.
What knocked me out as I was reading it again, and I noticed what you had predicted about this continual cycle of indebtedness and this money and the deflation and inflation. It almost knocked us out in the Clinton years, but boy, it really knocked us out now. And what the article that I read here a couple of weeks ago about from the Financial Times that actually declared a conspiracy. All right.
Yes.
It just knocked me out. I said everything that you stated is right there, and if that isn't proof enough, well, maybe you can give our audience a little more proof.
Well, you know, you have to realize something here. If you go through history, and you'll find out that sometimes there are individuals or groups that make some claims that are scoffed at or ignored. And then after a while, they become challenged. And then after another while, there will be all kinds of people who are claiming the same thing and saying that they're the ones that said it first. No?
Isn't that the truth?
The Bird Society has been ignored, and then the Bird Society has been challenged. And I think that we're coming up to a point now where there will be people who are saying the same thing that we are saying and claiming that they're the only ones that say it. Now, you mentioned this article that was in Financial Times. That was quite striking. There's a national columnist named Cal Thomas, and he's just written the same thing. He has said he's beginning to believe in conspiracy. He's beginning to believe that these people want to set up a one-world government. And, of course, here we have people now are discovering that we've been saying for 50 years, and now they're beginning to give the impression that they're the first ones that thought of it.
Well, even Glenn Beck, and you've heard of him.
Oh, yeah.
He's talked about it on his show.
He talked about the Richmond article?
No, he talked...
No, but he's talked about total devastation and conspiracy and New World Order and North American Union, and he says it's all going to hell in a handbasket, and we were quite surprised that he was...
Even mentioning it.
Yeah, we played a short clip tonight about it and we were very surprised to hear from him.
Well, you mentioned my book, Financial Terrorism. Of course, I wrote that in 1993.
Right.
Which means 15 years ago. And I laid out the scenario is what's going to be happening with inflation and massive debt leading to the loss of sovereignty and the end of our country. It was obvious to me then it didn't happen as fast as it's been happening lately, but nevertheless, it's still happening. And you get all these economists, and they're talking about this, and they're talking about that, and they're talking about something else, and they make no sense at all.
No, they don't, do they?
No, none of them really made any sense.
I gave a speech just a week ago, and in the course of the speech, I said, if you take all these economists and you lay them end to end, that would be fine.
That would be a good thing. What's your feeling about the Obama? I mean, I was shocked to see every single appointment almost that Obama made was a trilateralist, Bilberger, or CFR.
Well, he's made a lot of appointments that do fit that, and that has to be expected, I guess.
Yeah, I guess so.
It's all, Democrat or Republican. It's the Council on Foreign Relations that runs everything, so.
Yeah.
You've got Richardson in Commerce, and you've got Gates staying on in Defense. Tom Daschle now, Health and Human Services. Janet Napolitano is the Homeland Security. I always thought Homeland Security was the job of the military, but Timothy Geithner, Treasury. Lawrence Summer, National Economics Council. Eric Shinseki, Veterans Affairs. Susan Rice is going to be the new ambassador to the United Nations, and these are all Council on Foreign Relations members, by the way. And Susan Rice's position, Obama has said that he wants to elevate that to a full cabinet position.
Wow.
Shows what the importance he places on the United Nations.
Mm-hmm.
So where do you think? What do you see for the next for the first 100 days of the Obama administration here? Do you think we'll all be? I don't know. I don't even know.
I don't know what to expect.
What do you think?
I hope it's no worse than it's been during the Bush administration.
Okay.
Could be a lot worse. I hope that it's not going to be a lot worse than that, but you just don't know. I mean, this man is definitely way on the left, both social issues and foreign policy issues, economic issues. One of the things that impresses me about him is that he wants to hire several million people and have them work for the government, building roads or something else.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if his intention is to build the Trans-Texas Highway and
that's what I'm wondering too. And this infrastructure that he
hasn't been specific about it.
No,
he just says infrastructure.
That's going to be.
Well, it's a little early for him to be specific. I'll give him that much.
Mm-hmm.
But
he's talking about green jobs and all this kind of stuff. But I don't know.
Are you experiencing global warming where you live?
Whole
world. where I am.
Not quite.
Zero here.
We haven't seen too much of Al Gore since it's gotten cold, have we?
No.
That's another falsehood that they've projected on the American public.
Yeah, and there's a plan within the Obama camp. I don't know if it's the Obama himself. Within the Obama camp to replace the Kyoto Protocol that the United States never signed with another one that's going to come up in Poland, a place called Poznan.
Right.
That would be a compulsory winding down of industry in order to meet the demands of people regarding the putting into the atmosphere of carbon dioxide.
Well, there's one that there is something here that I read about a couple weeks back. Actually, I read it on the air, was this bill, Senate bill that Obama and Biden
sponsored,
and they approved it, I believe. It was for the Global Poverty Initiative or something?
Yes.
And they're giving out $65 billion a year?
Well, they plan to. They haven't done it yet.
UN
they want
tax? Yeah. But it's in the Senate right now, and I believe it's been approved by the Senate. I don't know if it's in the Senate.
Stop and realize that all bills at the end of a congressional session are dead.
Oh, okay.
So there's nothing before the Senate now. As soon as they meet again in the beginning of January, the Congress starts up again.
Right.
Then there will be all kinds of reintroduction of bills.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
If it didn't get passed by the Senate before they adjourned, then it's dead, but that doesn't mean it's not going to come up again.
Right.
And, of course, he'll have that honeymoon period where they try to pass as much legislation as possible.
Yeah, everybody's supposed to say, oh, we got a new president, we got to treat him kindly. And
right.
Don't treat the country kindly, just treat the president. You know?
Yeah.
What I'm concerned about is that this direction that we're going in with this huge inflation, Henry Hazlitt, who you quoted in your book, said it plants the seeds of fascism and communism, and it leads men to demand totalitarian control.
Exactly what happened in Germany in the 20s
mm-hmm.
led to the rise of Hitler, no doubt about it. It does get people to demand totalitarian controls. If you go to look at what's going on in Zimbabwe today
mm-hmm.
with the hyperinflation over there and people going to the supermarket and finding nothing there or things that aren't worth buying, you get to a point where people get desperate and they want very much to have somebody take over and do something.
Mm-hmm.
And usually what you want is the government to undo something, not do something, undo something.
Mm-hmm.
So...
No, go ahead. I'm sorry.
We've got that facing us, and it's a very serious situation.
You had a chart in your book, and I was just trying to locate it about the hyperinflation in Germany in 1928.
Yes.
And it was up to something like I don't remember if it was compared to dollars.
It did. It started off by saying $1 would buy 189 Reichsmarks.
And then it went all the way up to...
Less than 3 years later, $1 would buy $4 trillion.
$4 trillion, I know. It was, like, totally bizarre how that could possibly be. And, it was like... Yeah, here it is. By 1924... Like 22, it was 189, and then by 1924, it was 42 trillion. It was just absolutely unbelievable.
Yeah, and there have been other hyperinflation situations. Hungary endured it in 1946.
Really?
Yeah, that's probably the worst. Zimbabwe is getting close to what Hungary had in 1946.
Yeah, I think I heard it was something like 100,000. Whatever the Zimbabwe dollars
are. They call them Zim dollars, yeah.
Zim dollars, yeah, are equal to $1. Like 100,000 equal to $1 right now. So.
Yeah, well, you know, they're taking the currency and they're putting a rubber stamp on it and saying it's now worth another million times what it was worth yesterday. You know?
Right.
Well, do you think they'll come in and say, oh, we're going to rescue you with the Amero, which is going to make everything all right?
Here in America?
Hmm.
I don't know. It's something that has certainly been suggested by some people. They want that. They want the United States to merge with Mexico and Canada and form the North American Union with a new currency, which would be called the Amero.
Mm-hmm.
Would doesn't happen, but it's something that's being planned and being thought of, yes.
What's your opinion of Blagojevich here and the Obama people? The announcement that just came out today was that, nobody did anything wrong, but you know, it's pretty obvious that they did do something that they tried to cover up. What's your take on that?
Well, my take on that is you've got, I think, four previous governors of Illinois are in jail.
Yeah.
And this guy obviously belongs there as well. And if he mentioned to somebody that he would like to get paid off for nominating somebody to fill the Senate seat, that doesn't surprise me, and it shouldn't surprise anybody. But I don't think that they can convict him on a thing like that.
It must be something else that they haven't revealed, because, Obama himself was helping raise money for Hillary Clinton to pay her debts, and then she endorsed him.
Yeah.
I mean, Caroline Kennedy endorsed him, and now she wants to be...
that started challenging Obama's birth certificate.
Oh, uh-huh. I saw that, yes. And
this was a big
yeah.
Hillary Clinton supporter.
And they threw that out, but I think they're still trying to challenge it in some of the lower courts.
The other day, he said Obama is inheriting a foreign policy from hell,
mm-hmm.
and a domestic policy from double hell. And maybe 6 months down the road, he's going to say, you know, you were right about that birth certificate. I'm at it.
Yeah. I don't know where he's going to lead us.
But I weep for my country.
Yeah, me too. We're not in a good place right now, that's for sure.
No. Tell me. From Sunday, and it's not a good scene. Definitely not a good scene.
Tell me a little bit about the Council on Foreign Relations, John. Do you know how they go about recruiting their members?
Yeah, the members who are members suggest to somebody else. Within the group, they have a membership committee. They suggest within the group that this person ought to be considered. And we found out a little bit more than usual about that when William Buckley finally announced that he had been accepted as a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. And he said that he knew he had been nominated 10 years earlier. And he was a little upset at having to wait 10 years before they finally give him the honor of being a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. So, but there is a membership committee, and I guess names are constantly being offered to those on that membership committee as to who's going to be next, who's going to be anointed.
Now, how do they make sure that everybody is walking in the same direction?
They don't. I mean, what they do is they look around for people who are ambitious and maybe immoral,
mm-hmm.
They give them a chance. Some people get appointed to it in a 5-year term, and then they don't get renominated or don't get extended. There have been a few people over the years who were members of the Council on Foreign Relations that blew the whistle on them. Of course, that wasn't very well thought of or looked upon.
Uh-huh.
What's the chance of getting rid of the Federal Reserve? What possible chance do we have of
that? The chance of getting rid of the Federal Reserve is slim until more people begin to realize what's going on with the Federal Reserve. And, of course, what's going on with the Federal Reserve is that it is printing money, like going out of style, and that lowers the value of everybody's money. So when people begin to realize that. Now, the other thing is that if the legal tender laws could be done away with, then people could start alternate currencies.
Mm-hmm.
You could find somebody with a mint who's putting out the silver coins, gold coins, something of value.
Right.
Competition would do the Federal Reserve in.
That's for sure.
Yeah, competition always produces excellence, which is why the Federal Reserve has a monopoly. They can't handle competition. So there's a couple of things that could happen, one of them being what I just said, and the other is that Congress maybe might get to a point where there'll be enough people in Congress who are listening to Congressman Ron Paul, who is very much on top of this situation more than anybody in the country, really. And they might just say, well, you know, it's time to start thinking about doing something different. The thing about it that should be remembered is that Congress started the Federal Reserve in 1913, and if Congress started it, Congress can end it. It's as simple as that.
But what would they? I mean, what's it going to take for them to do this? I mean, is it going to take a revolution? I mean, basically, or what?
It's going to take more educated population, I guess. I don't think there's any other alternative, and of course that's what the John Birch Society was formed to accomplish, and what we continue to try to accomplish. Educate the public, and if you get enough people who understand, then things will change.
Do you feel like you're making headway with that?
Are we making headway? Yes.
Yeah.
The Birch Society is enjoying what we call a surge. You know, George Bush isn't the only one that can have a surge. A surge as well, and I'm thrilled about it.
That's great. That's great for you.
And
people are finally recognizing what you're doing.
Let's say more people are.
More people.
More people are, and of course, when people find out that it's going to cost $15 to buy a loaf of bread, and then price of fuel is going to go up, or the value of the dollar is going to go down. It'll take $100 to fill up your gas tank, and so on. Then we begin to approach what happened in Germany in the 20s, what happened in Hungary in the 40s, what's happening in Zimbabwe today. And
who do you feel is the most dangerous person today in the media?
In the media?
Yeah. Who do you think is the most? Who's the most?
There's so many that are dangerous. Anyone in particular?
Well, I'm looking at this guy. I'm looking at a picture. When I went through it, David Gergen is still there. He's a Bilderberger participant, the CFR Trilateral Commission. He's been counselor to two presidents. If anybody is dangerous, this guy seems to be. Do you think or what?
Well, yeah. I mean, he's got.
I mean, advice from this guy is like
he's got the credentials, but.
Mm-hmm.
I think the most dangerous man in the last several years has been Dick Cheney.
Oh, yeah.
Not in the media. He's something else. But to me, he's been very, very dangerous, very, very harmful.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
And he's CFR as well. You know, long time partner in that whole deal.
Who do you think Obama's Dick Cheney will be?
Who's going to be Obama's Cheney?
Yeah.
Yeah. Who is his big advisor?
Obama's a lot smarter than George W. Bush, and he might not need a Cheney.
Well, I think Jarrett is his top advisor.
Who?
Victoria Jarrett.
Oh, yes. I've seen that woman, yeah.
Yeah, she's his top.
She's in there. Well, this guy Rahm Emanuel is dangerous.
He's dangerous, yeah. Yeah, he really is.
He's not a CFR member yet.
No, why not? Okay, I'm surprised.
Yeah. I say yes. They don't have to be in the CFR to be dangerous, and some of them in the CFR are kind of nondescript. They just don't get involved in an awful lot of things.
Well, I remember somebody a couple years ago. I remember somebody said that he gave up the CFR because he was bored to death with it, and this was they asked him why he resigned. From the CFR, and he says it was just absolutely boring.
Yeah, I think that was John Kenneth Galbraith.
Was that who it was?
I think so. Yeah.
I couldn't remember, but So
years ago, there was a man named Sproul Braden, and Braden was a former ambassador to a former State Department official, and a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, and he tried to inject some real pro-Americanism into it, and he got shunned.
Yeah, I can imagine.
So he just said, well, I just stopped going. You know, they didn't throw me out. They didn't cancel my membership. I just stopped having anything to do with them.
What is the, if you could explain possibly to those people, to the audience, what is the CFR? Who are they? I mean, what do they represent? What are they? I mean, they're trying to actually undermine the country.
Well, you have to realize that the CFR was founded in order to promote the goal of world government.
Right.
That would be cancel the Declaration of Independence and toss away the Constitution of the United States. It was formed at the end of World War I when the United States Senate said no to the League of Nations. So we never got involved in the League of Nations. And because we didn't, immediately, the people who were promoting the world government idea with the League of Nations started the Council on Foreign Relations to condition more and more Americans to want world government. And immediately they began to get funding from the Rockefeller Foundation and the Carnegie Foundation and several others. And by the 1930s, they were invited by President Roosevelt to come in and take over the State Department. They've had control of it ever since. Now, the man who was the initial founder of it was a man named Edward Mandel House.
Oh, okay. He was
President Wilson's top
advisor.
Lived in the White House.
Right.
Was considered by Wilson as my alter ego, he used to say, my other self. Mm-hmm. House had written a book in 1912 before he was tapped by Wilson to be the top official in the White House, other than the president himself. He wrote a book, and in the book he said he was working for socialism as dreamed of by Karl Marx.
Yeah, I don't know.
What's interesting is that Franklin Roosevelt's mother gave him a copy of that book in 1920.
Huh.
And in 1932, when Franklin Roosevelt won the Democrat nomination in a convention in Chicago, which had a very conservative platform, he left Chicago and went straight to visit Edward Mandel House.
Wow.
First person he went to see as soon as he got the nomination.
I just don't understand yet. I mean, why they're so tolerated, why they're tolerated and have infiltrated every single...
Well, who's going to expose them? You're not going to get the New York Times to do it. They're all CFR
part of
people there.
Yeah.
You're not going to get Time and Newsweek and the other magazines to do it. They're headed by CFR people.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, what you look for is exposure in a place that you're not going to get it. And that's why there's a John Birch Society.
Now, John, I got to ask you this because I really think this question has bothered me. If they have been infiltrating this country since the 20s, all right, and they've done a damn good job at it because almost everybody in the White House now and in Congress is a member.
In the media?
No, that's not so. I would guess there are less than 20 members of the 435 in Congress who are members of the Council on Foreign Relations.
Oh.
But what you've got is you've got people who are afraid to speak out, who are afraid to buck the Council on Foreign Relations because columnists and media pundits and important newspapers and magazines will target them as being screwballs. So you get an awful lot of people to go along. And that, of course, is very dangerous. There are very few conspirators, but there are many, many people who go along to get along. And that's as big a problem as anything. If the Birch Society is successful, it will succeed by having people decide that the way to promote myself is to be a constitutional advocate, a person who is obeying the Constitution and the limitations on government, and so on.
Well, if you look back at the Bolsheviks in Russia during that period, they had less than 10%.
Right.
They seized control in a coup d'état, a military type.
Right.
We're not having a military type problem here. We're having the American people being buffaloed, I guess you could say.
John, this may seem like a dumb question, and it.
Oh, there's no such thing as a...
Do you believe that all of these members of the CFR that in the media, in various places, are they aware of what the objective is? Do you think they are consciously aware of it?
No, not necessarily. What they are aware of is that they follow along with the line that's being laid down,
mm-hmm.
because that's the one that gets them promotions, it gets them nice committee assignments, it gets them notoriety in the media.
Mm-hmm.
There are people that would write about this rising young, brilliant young congressman from whoever, you know, from take a good example, from Wyoming. That was Dick Cheney.
And so they prefer not to know anything really more about it.
Right.
Because it's getting them where they want to go and what they want.
Oh, yeah.
And their agenda is for themselves.
That's exactly right. That's right. Putting self above principle.
Right.
And
they really don't.
They all swear an oath to the Constitution, and then they put it in the bottom drawer and go about and do whatever they please. And nobody to blame but ourselves, because the American people should make everybody who swears an oath to that Constitution should make them abide by it.
Yeah, we should be more confrontational with our public figures.
Absolutely.
And it's our duty to be so. The media makes you feel, and they make you feel, like it's not your right to be confrontational.
Yeah, that's right.
And people get swayed by that, and they become afraid.
Yes.
And they shouldn't be, because that's what our duty is.
That's right. Right. I mean, the man who represents me in Congress is no smarter than I am. He's no more important in the long run than I am.
Mm-hmm.
And he should be held accountable, especially for his oath to office. Now, if the Constitution of the United States were fully enforced, the government would be 10% its size and 10% its cost.
Wow.
There would be no foreign aid. Imagine the United States, as heavily indebted as we are, and we still give away foreign aid.
I know, it's
amazing. You can ask a fourth grader if that's a smart thing to do, and he'd say no.
Right.
There would be no Department of Education, housing, welfare, medicine, transportation, energy, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. George Washington had 4 cabinet positions, and there's no need for more than 4.
What are those 4?
It's Secretary of State.
Right.
Secretary of Treasury.
Right.
Secretary of War.
Right.
Became Secretary of Defense. And an Attorney General.
That's true.
That's all he had.
Yeah. Amazing.
Now, do we need... You can look at the Department of Education has poured billions of dollars into education, and it continues to get worse. You can look at the Department of Energy. It was formed because we were importing 1/3 of our oil. And they have spent tens of billions of dollars, and now we're importing almost 2/3 of our oil.
Yeah, it gets worse and worse.
Makes you wonder, huh?
Somebody wrote something just recently. He said, here's the greatest joke of the century. And I looked and I said, oh, this, I have to look at this. I like a good joke. And it was the Department of Energy.
It wasn't a joke.
It was a sick joke.
That's why Richardson was the cabinet member there under Clinton.
Was he Secretary of Energy?
Yeah. And it was an absolute joke. You know, these.
Well, he's been ambassador of the United Nations too. He's been a governor. He's been a congressman. He's got a lot of credentials.
It looks like he's running.
And now he's been investigated.
Yeah. Now he's under investigation. So that's
yes.
For
campaign finance.
Well, no, CDR, a major financial group, gave him $1.5 million toward his campaign as governor, and he immediately
gave them a contract.
Gave them a huge contract for the state of.
That's kind of like what they get Al Capone for tax evasion.
Yeah. So, and then on top of that, the guy kept giving him $100,000 here and another $100,000 there, and then of course more and more contracts happened to be going to this guy.
And of course, after he cast his net far and wide, that company was the most qualified.
Most qualified, yes. After 1 or 2 months of investigation, he was far more qualified.
But unfortunately,
Richardson's the guy that betrayed Hillary Clinton.
Yeah.
I know.
I think that was a dangerous thing to do.
Well, I don't know.
Well, we'll see.
We'll see is right. She's going to be our Secretary of State.
A bit scary.
She will be the first Secretary of State in a long, long time that hasn't been a member of the Council on Foreign Relations.
I thought she was.
No, she's not. But
I think she's a Bilderberger. She was a Bilderberger attendee.
She's been alongside her husband.
Yeah.
All these different things.
Hmm.
But anyway.
You know, you hear a lot about this Caroline Kennedy now wants to be the new senator from New York.
Yeah.
And her qualification is that she's a Kennedy. That's all.
That's it.
She is also a member of the Council on Foreign Relations.
Ah, well, that makes her
qualified. That explains that, doesn't it?
Yeah.
That makes her qualified.
That makes her qualified, right?
Yeah.
But, John, we're over time here, and we've got to close down the show, but I want to thank you so much for coming out, and
my pleasure.
We wish you the best of Christmas.
Listening, jbs.org on the Internet.
Gotcha. JBS.org.
We're glad to hear from everybody, and Merry Christmas to you.
And a happy Christmas to you.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
All right, we'll
Good
talk
night.
To you again soon.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
Good night. And that was John McManus, president of the John Birch Society, commenting on Obama, the Council on Foreign Relations, and other events.
We are going to go.
We wish you all a happy Christmas.
Okay, that was actually recorded a couple weeks ago, right before Christmas, and we still relevant today. Everything is current, but we want to thank John. Great talker and great interview. Also, tomorrow night we're going to continue with our Agni Yoga series and the illumination, and I hope. And we're getting. We're getting near the two thirds toward the end of the book and of that particular book, and we'll be talking about that more tomorrow night. If you've been following the series, the Agni Yoga series, and Friday night we'll be with George Dixon will be with us, and they'll continue our discussion on 2012, the Mayan calendar. And the timelines and occurrences that and prophecies and findings and whatnot that all are relevant to the Mayan prophecies. So I want to thank everybody for joining us tonight. Hope you found the show interesting. And please stay with us tomorrow night and Friday night here at the same time. And if you happen to miss part of this program or other shows, please just go to our archives and full descriptions are there. Hope you enjoy. And I want to thank everybody who has been listening to our show. We've got a tremendous response to the program. And please tell your friends, neighbors, and all who are interested in what we have to say. Again, we appreciate it, and we hope you're having a beginning of a good new year, and hope it continues for you. So thank you, and good night.